Hello, this is Dr. Forbes again. We're going to be talking again about stopping and reversing diabetes. This is class number two. First things first, we're going to be talking about a number of different things. Like we spoke about before, we're going to be talking a little bit more about what diabetes is. Well, diabetes involves this organ right here. It is the pancreas. You can see this actually represents the mouth. Then this is the esophagus. It goes down to the stomach. The food goes through here, and it goes through the stomach, and it goes into the small intestines right in this area. But this is the pancreas. The pancreas is an organ or tissue that puts out insulin. And when you have diabetes, that doesn't work the way it's supposed to. So the pancreas is very important to us. It makes insulin. It makes enzymes, and both are essential for normal body function. We're going to talk first about the enzymes. Enzymes are introduced into the small intestines, and they break down starches into simple sugars. This is very important for diabetics. And it also helps to break down simple sugars down into glucose. Starches are basically long chains of sugars. So anytime that you see starch, you can just say sugar just as easily. The thing is that starch takes about 8 to 12 hours to break down into sugars, whereas simple sugars take minutes to an hour to get into the bloodstream. Now, glucose, which is the simplest sugar and all sugars gradually break down into, are essential for the body to function well. But too much glucose causes problems. Now, the pancreas enzymes also do other things. They break down fats and proteins into smaller particles so that they can get into the body, so that the body has the nutrition that it needs. Now, insulin is produced by the pancreas, but it's put directly into the bloodstream. Now, it pushes blood sugar or glucose into the cells, and it's supposed to do that rather rapidly, so that's why we get that little energy push oftentimes whenever we eat a very sugary food. That's the reason why you see kids sometimes when they eat sugary foods, they start, as we parents say, start bouncing off the walls. Well, this is where that comes from. Now, high blood sugar, which is what diabetics eventually develop, permanently damages many different organs and tissues, such as the nerves, the kidneys, the eyes. It damages many things. The skin is a very common one. What are we talking about? Many have heard of diabetic ulcers. These are openings or breaks in the skin that don't heal well. So this high blood sugar permanently damages these tissues. Now, all the cells of the body need glucose for food and for energy, especially the brain. The brain does not function well when it doesn't have enough glucose. And whenever you have a low blood sugar, it's the reason why you feel suddenly tired, or some people actually will pass out because the brain doesn't have enough blood sugar and it lays you down. Hypoglycemia, we talked about that before, is a precursor to diabetes. It comes before diabetes, and some people feel it, some people don't feel it, or some people don't recognize what it is when they do feel it. Now, if we start out with a normal pancreas and we add lots of high sugary and starchy foods, that's going to give a high amount of insulin. Why is the high amount of insulin? Because the pancreas will be able to sense this high amount of sugar, and it puts out enzymes and other things to help to push it into the bloodstream, but it also puts out insulin because it knows that the blood sugar is coming into the body. And then, because the insulin pushes lots of that blood sugar suddenly into the bloodstream, it creates that low blood sugar. This is oftentimes what we feel sometimes soon after we've eaten the sugar. Sometimes we'll feel a letdown. And this is pretty normal and pretty typical whenever you eat a high sugary meal. Anybody ever eaten a large meal and suddenly they feel very tired? And I'm not talking about eating turkey that has a natural high amount of tryptophan where it makes you kind of sleepy. But if you eat too large of a meal, oftentimes the pancreas is working overtime and it'll make you feel tired shortly after that. If you do this time after time, day after day, year after year, then you get a repetitive problem that causes an overworked pancreas. And then what happens is, during this time at any rate, you have lots of low blood sugars and you're not feeling so well. But this eventually, with an overworked pancreas, can cause problems where the sugar gets too high in the bloodstream, and then we get to a different problem. But just to go over a few basic points, what is hypoglycemia? Well, it's low blood sugar. This leads to a stressed pancreas, and it oftentimes is caused by high amounts of mental stress that puts pressure on the pancreas as well. And a lot of the foods that stress the pancreas, we know what those are. Those are your sugary and your high starchy foods. So hypoglycemia has a lot of symptoms associated with it. The most common is frequent tiredness, or that's also known as fatigue, or weakness. These two symptoms are the most common things that people feel when they have hypoglycemia. So oftentimes, though, you'll also have high amounts of abdominal pain, and it sometimes leads to those afternoon low sugar blues. Sometimes after you've eaten your midday meal, you'll feel this sugary blues. A lot of people know what that feels like at about 3 or 4, and they feel really tired, and they don't feel like working. It can cause high amounts of anxiety, blurred vision, depression, and double vision. It can also cause drowsiness. It can make your heart beat fast or pounding. And you can feel kind of cranky. Or some kids, especially, you'll notice they get very aggressive. And this oftentimes leads to children being diagnosed with other things where they give them medication for attention deficit and such. This can cause you to feel nervous, and it's difficult to concentrate. Ever seen children, whenever they've had high blood sugar, they have a really short attention span, and they find it hard to concentrate. Well, that's true as adults as well. If you frequently get too much sugar, and it's causing a low blood sugar situation. Then it can also give you a headache. It can make you feel very hungry at times as it gets worse. And some people even feel shaking or trembling. It can get so severe. And oftentimes people can feel, they can end up with sweating, or they can have sweaty palms. And later on, it can actually cause some tingling or numbness of the skin, difficulty sleeping, and they just feel like it's just hard to think. But the thing is that most people don't realize is most of the time there are simply no symptoms. And many hypoglycemics write off most of the symptoms, if they have them, as whenever they eat something, it seems to help it. Why? If you've got a low blood sugar and you're eating something sugary, oftentimes it will cause those symptoms to lessen, so they feel like, well, I was just hungry. But sometimes it could actually be hypoglycemia. Severe hypoglycemia can be a serious problem, as extreme low blood sugars can have certain consequences, and some people have fainted, had seizures, or been in a coma as a result. So these are very serious problems if they come about. Now, fasting blood sugars may be normal whenever you have hypoglycemia. Why? Taking one reading may not show you a complete pattern. So what we recommend to know what you're dealing with is a 5 or 6 hour glucose tolerance test. We'll talk about that shortly. And that's the way we can oftentimes find out if a person has hypoglycemia, or if they're normal, or if they have diabetes. But we'll talk of testing a little bit later. The next thing, once hypoglycemia gets more severe, oftentimes people end up as a pre-diabetic. And what is a pre-diabetic? Well, this is where the pancreas function begins to fluctuate as it's very tired and sick and not functioning as well. So oftentimes, what ends up happening with the same eating, it doesn't give the person nearly as much comfort whenever they have those blood sugars, because sometimes the blood sugar just stays high or it stays low because the pancreas is either overworking or underworking. If it's overworking, then what it's doing is it's forcing low blood sugars. But if it's underworking because it's getting so tired, the blood sugar just simply remains high. And that means basically that the pancreas produces too little sugar if it's overworked, or too much sugar, or too much, I'm sorry, the pancreas produces too little insulin if it's being overworked. And if it's working like it should, it's producing too much insulin because we're eating too many sugary products. So the symptoms of pre-diabetes are basically a lot of the same symptoms as hypoglycemia, but their hunger really goes up a lot higher, and they start to be feeling much more thirsty. Now, just because you feel thirsty doesn't necessarily mean you have pre-diabetes or hypoglycemia. A good hot day in any climate, you're going to be thirsty, but we're talking about an abnormal thirst, even in spite of being in a cool environment or normal circumstances. But you know what? Even in this phase, the most common thing is that they don't have any symptoms at all, which is sometimes very, very frustrating. Now, fasting sugars for a pre-diabetic may be low normal or mildly high, so they don't really tell us that unless we're doing that 5 to 6 hour glucose tolerance test. And we'll again talk of the testing a little bit later. Diabetes is the next phase of this sugar-related condition. And this is where the pancreas totally fails. And that's where no or little or very little insulin is produced. And so you end up with almost consistently high blood sugars because there's nothing really significant to push the blood sugars into the cells. And because of this, cells begin to suffer. Eating doesn't seem to help the symptoms that you have, and they end up with digestive problems like gas, bloating, constipation, and diarrhea. The symptoms of diabetes are very similar to the symptoms of hypoglycemia and prediabetes, but in addition to that, they have usually more frequent bouts of fatigue or tiredness, nausea. They tend to notice that they urinate more frequently. Sometimes people have to go frequently during the night. Now, this can be symptoms of things besides diabetes, but this is very common that we see. Oftentimes, I didn't put it here, the urine begins to even smell sweet, and this is something we have to look at as well. Excessive thirst, blurred vision. They have infections that don't heal very well and sores that don't heal. You've heard of diabetic ulcers where the skin breaks open. Oftentimes this is on the feet. And as the condition gets worse, they don't heal very, very readily. Sometimes they have to have specialized wound care. And the lesions or openings in the skin from a typical scrape might take months and months to heal, even with proper treatment, because it doesn't heal fast because of the diabetes. But initially, when they get diabetes, they might not have any symptoms either. Oftentimes, it's not unusual to see people going into their doctor for a regular checkup, and suddenly they're finding they have diabetes, and they still haven't really had any significant symptoms. That's the very frustrating part of this. But if eating does help, it's reducing the symptoms, but it's not helping the conditions. Now, people say, well, doc, I'm just going to genetically get it. Well, this may or may not be true, but if you have a family history of diabetes, it means that you will or you may or you won't develop diabetes. What are we talking about? Well, if you do the right things, you're going to lower your risk and make it extremely unlikely. I myself, my grandmother and my father both had diabetes, but I will tell you, I'm running an exceptionally high probability that I will never develop diabetes because I've made changes in my diet and lifestyle. And that doesn't mean that I can't eat good foods and can't eat sugars and other things, but I have to be very careful about it. It's important to realize that we have to do things to lower our risk of developing the condition. Now, the things that we need to do when we have these things is to make sure you have a good diagnosis and to monitor your condition. That's what you have to do at the minimum, but that's not going to get you to the point where you can reverse it. We'll be talking about that, about stopping and reversing as we go along. But we've got to have good monitoring practices so that we can stop and know whenever the condition is beginning to reverse and when the pancreas is healed. So we're going to be talking about some of the different ways to do that. Now first, you do pretty much have to have professional guidance. Your treating physician does your basic blood work, and they might do some of the other blood work that you need, but you might need that AHP, the alternative health provider, to help you with this as well. Now, a fasting blood glucose level tells you your fasting blood sugar. What are we talking about? That's when they tell you, don't eat the night before and come in the morning, and then we're going to test your blood sugar. That's a one-time thing. Then you've got the hemoglobin A1C. It's represented by the HbA1c, usually on blood tests. Now this tells you what your blood sugar has been on average for the last 90 days or 3 months. You also have a 6-hour glucose tolerance test. That's one of the most important things, that, and we'll talk about that on the next slide. And food allergy testing, because some people actually have food allergies that cause this problem. Well, we'll talk about those last two things separately, but let's go over the hemoglobin A1C. This test is what we oftentimes call a cheat test. You can seemingly have been, quote, good for the last few days, and your fasting blood glucose will be fine. But if your hemoglobin A1C is high, we know that there's been a lot of cheating going along in the last 90 days. It's a good test so we can know that you're abiding by what we're telling you to do. And it's very important. It does make a big difference. Now, let's go on to some of the other testings. Now, the fasting blood glucose, let's go over the normal values for that. Normally, it should be between 70 and 100. If it's higher than that, it's prediabetes. If it's below 125, but if it's 126 or more, you have diabetes. So that's the values that are typically followed. They may be a little different from lab to lab and from doctor to doctor, but these are the generally recognized norms. Now the hemoglobin A1C, it tells you, like I said, how you've done over the last 90 days. We like to see it between 4 and 5.6%. If it's higher than that, we know that your blood sugar has been higher. And that tells us that if you're at risk and if you have diabetes. So there's the values there for you. So if it's 6.5% or more, then we know that you definitely do have diabetes. Now the glucose tolerance test is truly a stress test for the pancreas. Now this is a diagram. What we do, the way the glucose tolerance test runs, is you take a blood sugar level at the first time, a fasting blood sugar, and then they give you a 100 milligrams of a glucose substance. That way we know exactly how your body responds. Then they take the blood sugar again, or they take a blood draw again, so they can check the blood sugar at a half an hour, and then an hour from that beginning time, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, and 6 hours. And when you connect the dots, it's going to form some type of graph. A true diabetic, it's going to just shoot up here very early, and it's just going to stay up in this area. You can see that these blood sugars are well above the established norms in here, but it tends to stay high. But you know what? The pre-diabetic, it's still going to go up, and their pancreas still has some ability to work, and it's going to come down below normal and then go back to normal. The hypoglycemic person is going to go up a little higher than normal, go down lower than normal, and then come back up to normal. The normal individual, their blood sugar should go up to about 140s or something at the most, and then come down back to normal and typically stay about there. It might come down just a little lower than normal, but back up. Now, the interesting thing is the person who has allergies and they have typically hypoglycemic symptoms, it will actually, the blood sugar does weird things. It doesn't go up very high, and then it comes down low, and it tends to stay low there, and then gradually getting back up to normal. Now, if you have allergies, that's something of a different nature. Now, we've talked about allergies in two respects. We've talked about allergies whenever you just have an allergy, I'm allergic to this food, but there's also allergies sometimes to foods to where you are not able, your blood sugar does not follow norms, and so you're very tired frequently. Well, let's look at some of the different ways that we can test allergies so that we can see what they do to you. Now, there's three basic types of testing. We've got the RAS testing. Actually, we have that a little bit wrong on there. We've got skin testing, which there's different tests. They call them either the scratch test, the intradermal test, or the patch test. Now, all these tests basically are done the same way, and what they do is they take that substance and they scratch the skin with it, and then they look at how it responds over a period of time. Now, oftentimes they will do this on the arm, but this does it. This particular picture we're showing you because it was just easier to look at. You can do it on just about any part of the body, and then they just have to know what they scratched your skin with. They normally don't do this with more than 13 substances typically, and then you have to wait a period of time before you can do more substances. It seems that the testing can be seemingly very accurate. It does take a long time to find out what if you're allergic to anything. Okay, and depending on how much redness they see, they determine if that's a positive or a negative test with the different ones. Now, the scratch test, they're actually scratching the skin with it. Intradermal, they're actually injecting it into the lower skin level. And the patch test is actually something where they're putting it in contact with the skin, and I don't have a picture of that, but they're actually putting a patch on top of the skin. This is oftentimes safer for people who have peanut allergies to see if they're actually allergic. There's blood testing. Now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the ELISA and RAS are the most common ones. And this just shows you a common graph of comparing the two different tests. But basically, this is where they're taking a blood sample and they're exposing it in the laboratory to various things so that they can see what you might be allergic to and to what degree. Now, I have found that blood testing, there is a live cell analysis as well where they can do something similar. But I have found that sometimes the blood testing is not nearly as accurate as the skin testing or the test we're going to go over in a moment, which is called the MSAS testing. Why is that? Well, I've actually had patients who they found that they were allergic to a number of different substances, and we find out using other methods that they're actually not allergic to those. So I would have to say that this is probably not one of the better tests. I had a patient recently, a little boy who was just deathly scared of every time they would take blood draws. And I don't know about you, when I was a little child, I hated to be stuck with a needle. And I went into it kicking and screaming. But to draw blood, you have to realize there are certain reactions that happen, a fight or flight mechanism, and there may be other substances in the blood that are secreted as a result of that, adrenaline and other things. And this, I believe, can influence that testing. And there may be other things in the blood that can influence that testing. Because, for example, that child that we saw that had this, they found that he was allergic. It had been a growing list over a period of years, and actually through that time, he had done more his reaction to being stuck with a needle was worse and worse on each successive testing. And last time, that the mother was just almost in tears because they said basically it was nothing that child could eat. I said, well, that just doesn't make sense. The child's been eating, and I haven't seen any obvious signs of that. So we did some other type of testing and found that truly he did have some food allergies, but most foods he was not allergic to. So sometimes these tests can be inaccurate. So I'm not as big of a fan of the blood testing for that reason. Now, what we use in my office is the MSAS testing, and we do sometimes recommend some other testing, but this is a very easy test that we can do inside the office. And if you can find somebody who uses this, it's called the MSAS Professional. This is using a form of meridian stress analysis, and there are other units out there that you can find that will do this. In my opinion, this is one of the better units to be able to use. I've done a variety of testing in my office like this through the years. This is one of the best units that I've found, and you can go online and find practitioners who use this or call them at their office. It's an in-office test. There is no invasiveness to it. There's no scratching. This is basically where the person is holding an electrode, and then we're testing with one of them at various points on the hands and on the feet. And what we're focused on in allergies is points that have to do with the allergies. And there's several points on each hand that we can use for this that can establish chemical sensitivities and food allergies. So this is one of the tests that we use. And in a space of an hour, we can test hundreds of different foods very, very easily without having to worry about it, because the computer has that's connected to the MSAS Professional has a whole database of various foods, and we can establish using the readings from the unit as to whether or not the likelihood of them having a reaction to that food and the degree of a reaction to that food. This is also helpful as we're improving the health of the body. Those food allergies in most instances do reduce down. Now, some people say, Doc, what about peanut allergies? Well, peanut allergies are more extreme. That gives you an anaphylactic shock. But you know what? I've not had a patient in my office that where we've focused on the peanut allergies, but I have friends of mine, and I know patients who used to be allergic to peanuts, and they no longer have to be allergic to peanuts. That is a very select number, and it has to be handled very, very fragilely or very specially whenever we're looking at trying to reverse a peanut allergy. The focus of the peanut allergy is not so much that they can necessarily eat peanuts, but so that if they're exposed to them, they're not going to get an anaphylactic shock. That's what we're looking for. But it can be reduced, and that can be very helpful to the individual. Whether or not they ever eat a peanut again in their life, many things are made with peanuts. But getting back to the hypoglycemic who has food allergies that's causing that hypoglycemia, that can eventually lead to diabetes. So it's very important to finding these food allergies. And oftentimes we find there's a nutrient imbalance that can cause this. And as we begin to improve that, their hypoglycemia improves and they begin to feel much better, and they're able to get back to normal lives with better energy. So this is something truly that does have to be looked at from an alternative health provider, the HAHP that you have, as we've spoken of in the previous section. So be sure and look back at that and get with an AHP if you've not already done so, so that you can find out if this is true. Now, one of the things I want to go back for a moment to the I want to go back to the glucose tolerance test. Now, what I want you to realize is this is an extremely important test, and I want to emphasize it. This is the test that you can do initially, and I know it's not a comfortable test. Some people really don't like that 100 grams of glucose because it's so stinking sweet. My wife hates, she's had to do that test, and it's made such a big difference because we can find out when the pancreas is strong again. So let's look at this test not only as the status of what you are, but this actually stresses the pancreas. None of the other tests that we showed you actually stress the pancreas. So we can see how it functions under a load. This is something that we can do, say, whenever you start seeing your blood sugars improving, when you start seeing your condition improving, this can be a very important test so that we can actually make a big proclamation and be able to say, hey, this is starting to work for you. Your pancreas is getting stronger. And do you know what we do whenever we find that as these graphs begin to improve, and instead of looking like very abnormal, they're starting to look more normal, then what we say is, wow, let's start looking at trying you on some true starches and other things, and maybe eating additional amounts of this or that because your pancreas is starting to improve. And that's whenever you see, if you're a true diabetic, you start seeing this type of a reaction where the pancreas, what this tells you when this dips down, this tells you that pancreas is producing insulin. That's what that tells you. Now, some people might say, well, doc, I'm taking insulin. What can I do, even do this test? Of course you can. We're only talking about 6 hours. And some diabetics can actually do this at home. There's an at-home method where you can eat a certain amount of, take for example, you can get a certain amount of Sprite, which is what I recommend. You look on the label and you drink as much, I think it's about 6 or 7 ounces. I could be mistaken. I'll look that up and get that on at another time. But you want to look at the grams of sugar in, say, a Sprite. It doesn't have anything in it other than sugar and water and flavoring. And it doesn't have caffeine or anything like that. And you can actually run this test yourself using your own blood stick monitor. And you can do this. But now I do caution you. Do not do the test too frequently. This does put stress on the pancreas. I would suggest doing this no more than once every 6 months. And that just to see how things are coming. And what you're looking for within 6 months to a year, if you're a full-fledged diabetic and the graph is way up here, we want to see some changes. We want to see that starting to dip down and further so that we know that it's improving. You may still have high blood sugars, that you may go back through these phases from a diabetic to a pre-diabetic to a hypoglycemic, but eventually we want to see you back to normal. Very, very important. So let's talk about what we're talking about, what we need to do. This is, going back to food allergies. Sorry, I had a little bit more to do. What we want to do with food allergies is we want to identify what they are. And we go through a process to avoid them, to repair. What are we talking about there? Getting you on a proper nutrient support so that you can overcome it, getting your body back into balance. And then we work on reintroducing those self-same foods and see if you're truly allergic any longer and you're not causing any problems. But you, like we've mentioned before, you want to avoid reintroducing severe allergies like peanuts unless you're working with an AHP, your alternative health provider, and the treating physician. Very, very important. So this is what we're wanting you to do. It's important to create a baseline for this glucose tolerance test. So I would suggest getting with your AHP or with your treating physician and doing one of these tests for a baseline. Now, some treating physicians, medical docs say, you don't need to do it but for about 2 or 3 hours. No, you want to do the full at least 5 hours, if not 6 hours. You may as well get the most bang for your buck, so to speak, so that we can truly see what's going on for that significant period of time. I've seen those who come in with 2 or 3 hour glucose tolerance tests, and they just don't oftentimes give me enough information, and we end up having to redo that. So make sure it's at least 5 hours. Very important. Now, if you're not on insulin, you can do this with your alternative health provider or treating physician. All right. If you're on insulin, you want to definitely do that with your treating physician in the mix with that. Okay? So if your food allergies, once you've done the glucose tolerance test, begin looking into testing with the AHP to find out which foods that you need to avoid. So we go through that process like we talked about before. Now, what's coming up in our next session, we're going to be talking about what not to eat. Now, you might say, oh, I know what not to eat, Doc. Well, you might be surprised at some of the things that we talk about. And this is a very important topic for lots of you that like to have that sweet tooth. We're going to be talking about some good sugar alternatives. You say, Doc, I know what good sugar alternatives are. Well, sometimes, you know, and I've had many people that are misled with certain sugar alternatives, and they've been told the wrong information, and they end up suffering for it. So until next time, we will help you, and we will do everything we can. Don't forget to check in for my webinars, and with questions, please email me or send them through the website to me, and we will answer those at the webinars. I can't emphasize that enough, that it's going to make a big difference. We want to get your questions answered to the best of our ability. Have a great day.